Thanks very much, Lance. Good morning, everyone. And I thank the conference organisers for the invitation to speak here today. I've been asked to talk about the outlook for payments regulation. There's a subject that's very much front of mind at the moment. We've had the Murray recommendations just recently come out in that area. And as you know, the Reserve Bank Payment System Board has its own review process looking at those recommendations at the moment. I'm going to say a bit more about that review a little bit later, but I have to begin by saying that the PSB review process is still underway, and I'm not going to be in a position today to preempt anything that might come out of that. What I want to do instead is to try and approach the subject in a more indirect way by giving you an overview of the work of the PSB in the period between the two major inquiries, Ross and Murray. What's the PSB general approach? What has that approach been since we entered the field? And what have been the consistent principles that have been applied? And hopefully that'll give you a few clues as to the way we're approaching matters currently. The Reserve Bank's role as regulator of retail payment systems was established following the report of the Wallace Inquiry in 1997. Like Murray, the Wallace Inquiry was about more than just payments. It was about the financial system as a whole. And Wallace took a holistic approach to the role of payments within the wider financial system. I suggest looking back at Wallace that there were four key observations that shaped the overall recommendations that came out of that. First of all, Wallace observed that the business model for the traditional banking sector was fundamentally changing. In simplified terms, you could think of banks as being providers of a portfolio of services, which the three main ones were deposits, loans, and transaction services. And in the highly regulated environment that existed then, those things tended to be provided on a whole institution basis by full service banking institutions. Credit was heavily rationed, and borrowers needed to demonstrate their loyalty to a bank in order to qualify for loans. In that environment, you tend to get a market where the net interest margin was high by banking mediation, customers were not mobile. And banks were in a position to cross-subsidise payment services as part of their overall package. And so payment services tended to be delivered as a utility within that kind of environment. That model broke down over time because of the combined effects of deregulation and financial innovation. Those forces enabled new players to come in and compete separately for the most profitable lines of business. Examples of that on the deposit side were cash management trusts, which enabled depositors to get access to wholesale interest rates. On the lending side, mortgage securitizers were able to compete in a very highly profitable area and take business away from the banks in that part of their business. And all of that worked to compress interest margins and reduce the scope for cross-subsidization. This was the phenomenon of unbundling, which Wallace talked about a great deal. It meant cross-subsidies being competed away, and different components of the banking service portfolio had to be separately priced, including payments. One of the early manifestations of that, which Wallace talked about, was the increased incidence of highly unpopular transaction fees for bank accounts. But of course, there were implications that were much more widely than that, and which is still being seen today in the way that banks do business. That was the first observation of Wallace, the unbundling phenomenon. Secondly, Wallace noted the importance of technology and innovation. At conferences like the one we're at today, it's impossible not to be struck by the pace of innovation, the scope for the industry to innovate. The specifics of that, of course, couldn't have been foreseen 18 years ago when Wallace presented his report, but what the report did foresee was the general tendency for the industry to innovate and for the trend towards electronic and card-based payments away from traditional instruments like cash, cheques, and all of that is still continuing today. The third observation from Wallace, related to the first two, is that Wallace foresaw the growth of payments systems as a business in its own right, in contrast to the utility-based models that had existed earlier. Commercial realities were leading to the unbundling of payments from other financial services, and it's to be expected in that environment that new businesses are going to come in and offer innovative and specialist services. It also meant that the existing providers were going to have to put their own payment services on a more commercial footing. And the fourth thing from Wallace was that the Wallace Inquiry looked at the regulatory implications of all of those first three. Payment systems and networks which link service providers and their customers. That means that they need to have ways of ensuring adequate coordination among network members who in other circumstances would be competing with each other. Now that in turn raises a whole suite of questions about whether particular network arrangements are efficient. For example, is there appropriate access to a network? Are the pricing arrangements efficient? And are there effective coordination mechanisms to ensure network innovation? Wallace concluded from all of those things that there needed to be a framework for regulatory oversight of payment systems, and the recommendations that flowed out of that formed the basis for the regulatory arrangements that we have today. To summarise just briefly the main elements of that, Wallace recommended that the Reserve Bank be given powers of the payments regulator, that those powers be vested in a separate board with a majority of independent directors, the Payment System Board. That the mandate of that board should be to promote efficiency, competition, and stability in payment systems. And at a starting point, the PSB should look at credit card schemes with a particular focus on access arrangements, pricing, and speed rules. Wallace also recommended that the PSB maintain a more general watching brief on the efficiency and capacity for innovation in the system as a whole. Looking back on the work of the PSB since that time, it's very much followed the original design and philosophy that came out of Wallace. The early work of the PSB focused on credit card systems, leading to a package of reforms in 2003. That was followed by reforms to debit card systems in 06 and to the ATM network in 09. I think it's also fair to say that the original regulatory philosophy that was enunciated at that time has been followed through. In implementing the Wallace recommendations, the government's intention was that the policy approach should be co-regulatory. The explanatory memorandum to the law, which set up the PSB's powers in 1998, states this in the following words: the philosophy of the bill is co-regulatory. Industry will continue to operate by self-regulation, in as far as such regulation promotes an efficient, competitive, and stable payment system. Where the RBA considers it in the public interest to intervene, the bill empowers it to designate a payment system and develop access regime standards in close consultation with industry and other interested parties. That's from the original explanatory memorandum in 1998. As I said, the approach taken by the PSB since its inception has very much been consistent with that intent. The PSB directly regulates only five payment systems and only limited areas. That is, in interchange fees, restrictions on merchants, transparency, and access. In contrast to the more interventionist approach of some other jurisdictions, the Australian framework really for many aspects of the payment system and the regulator. This philosophical approach has also very much guided the PSP's work on payment system innovation. I've already talked about the industry's enormous capacity to innovate, so why does the PSP need to take an interest in this area? Well, I think the answer to that lies in the distinction between proprietary innovations, which are carried out at the level of individual payments businesses, and network innovation, which takes place at the level of the system as a whole. As you'd expect, the industry is very good at innovation in the proprietary space, and we see examples of that all around us. Some of the examples that I'd cite would be cardless ATM withdrawals, new authentication techniques such as fingerprint, digital wallets, banking and payment apps. These are all areas where the incentives to innovate at the business level are clearly very effective. But it's well recognised that efficient innovations can be more difficult to achieve at the level of the system as a whole, because available incentives don't necessarily support coordinated action. Consistent with the Wallace vision, the PSP has been active in promoting coordinated industry solutions that were in the public interest. One early example of that was in encouraging faster check clearing, an obvious improvement in system efficiency that couldn't have happened without an effective coordination. On a larger scale, the PSP more recently undertook a strategic review of innovation in the payment system, the results of which were published in 2012. That review was conducted over a two-year period. It involved extensive consultation with both the payment industry and with payment services users. We found a number of areas where there was scope for system improvements that can only be achieved through coordinated action. The key ones, just to summarise, were same-day settlement for direct entry transactions, faster payments and out-of-hours payments to be made generally available, the capacity for richer information to travel with payments, and a progressing solution for electronic payments. The first one of those that I just mentioned was delivered at the end of 2013, and that essentially involved an acceleration of existing direct entry processes. But the remaining ones together form a more ambitious agenda, and taken together they're being taken up as part of the industry's new payments platform, the MPP project. The MPP is a successful example of what can be done through collaboration between the industry and its regulator. It's also a good example of the catalyst role for the PSP in promoting system innovation that was envisaged originally by Wallace. While it's an industry-led project, it's strongly supported by the PSP, and the board continues to encourage commitment to the project and timely completion. The project was launched in early 2003 and is now well advanced. We'll be hearing more about it later, but just to make a few remarks on progress to date. Our current schedule in the MPP will deliver a fast payment service with rich information and addressing capabilities in the second half of 2017. It will be linked to a fast settlement service provided by the Reserve Bank, which will allow transactions to be cleared and settled 24/7 in close to real time. All of that will amount to a world-class payments infrastructure. It will also be a platform for further innovation. One of the key decisions that was made at an early stage of the project was to separate the basic clearing and settlement infrastructure from the commercially based overlay services that would use it and have access to it. The industry is committed to an initial overlay that will provide an attractive service and drive early growth in volumes through the system. But it's important to note that access to the overlay space has always been intended to be open and competitive. over time, that structure will allow new and specialist providers to make use of the rich capabilities provided by your infrastructure. Now, before moving on to some more detailed regulatory matters, I'll just mention one more initiative to have come out of the 2012 strategic review, and that is the establishment of new industry coordination and consultation arrangements. In line with a recommendation from that review, a new industry coordination body, the Australian Payments Council, was launched last year. The council is a high-level body representing a diverse range of industry participants, including banks, payment schemes, and other service providers. It will have the capacity to give strategic direction to the industry, as well as to engage in dialogue with the PSP. At the same time as setting that up, however, it's important that the PSP and the policy process more generally take into account the requirements of users, not just suppliers to payment services. And to facilitate that, the Reserve Bank has also set up a payments users consultation group, which began meeting late last year. So in summary then, the policy work of the PSP has been very much consistent with the philosophy and objectives that were originally laid out by Wallace. A good deal of that work has been what might be called co-regulatory in nature, in the sense that it involves promoting industry-led solutions rather than using formal regulatory powers. But of course, the PSP does have a regulatory mandate, and it has used its powers to regulate a number of aspects of card payments where it judged that there was a public interest case to do so. Probably the aspects of this regulation that have attracted the most attention have been those related to interchange and surcharging, and I'd like to say some general things about each of those now. First of all, interchange. The commercial function of interchange fees is a very interesting one. They serve as a device for shifting the benefit cost balance between issuers and acquirers in a four-party payment scheme, and therefore indirectly between cardholders and merchants. Payment schemes argue that this can be an important competitive device that can promote innovation, for example, by being structured to encourage network growth or the take-up of new products. Typically, interchange flows from the acquirer to the issuer, and so the fee structure tends to encourage issuance and use of the card, but it may discourage acceptance by merchants if the fees are set too high. For mature schemes, however, the capacity of merchants to refuse acceptance may be quite limited. As a result, it's been frequently observed that competition between schemes can have the effect of pushing fees up rather than down in order to maximise incentives to issuers and cardholders. The reason that this kind of outcome is possible is that there's a misalignment between the incidence of these fees and the structure of decision-making power in a typical transaction. To put it in a nutshell, the cardholder chooses the payment instrument, but the merchant pays the fee. In designing its card payment reforms, both for credit and debit, the PSP concluded that competition of this nature was distorting price signals in a way that inefficiently encouraged the use of high-cost cards and added to merchant costs. Hence, it judged that there was a case for interchange fees to be capped by regulation. A number of other jurisdictions have since taken a similar view. The second aspect that I wanted to talk about is surcharging. The PSP has consistently taken the view that merchants shouldn't be prevented from surcharging for higher cost payment methods. Scheme rules that prohibited surcharging had the effect of reinforcing the distorting effects of interchange fees by preventing price signals from flowing on to cardholders. They also reduced the flexibility of merchant response when faced with a high value, with a high cost card. The ability to surcharge gives merchants a wider range of possible responses rather than just being faced with the binary decision to accept or reject a particular card. Efficient surcharging, of course, should reflect the underlying payment cost. The PSB's initial reforms to credit and debit gave merchants the right to surcharge, while effectively relying on competition to ensure that surcharging wouldn't be excessive. This regulation was revised in 2013 in response to concerns about developments that have taken place since the initial reforms, particularly about surcharging that had developed that appeared to be excessive or unrelated to that costs. The amended regulation now still prevents schemes from imposing those surcharge rules, but it allows them to limit surcharging to the reasonable cost of acceptance. In doing so, it strikes a balance, at least in principle, between the rights of merchants and schemes. Merchants can't be prevented from recovering their costs, but they can be prevented by scheme rules from going beyond that. More on that in a moment. The PSB's reforms to surcharging and interchange form part of a broader package that also included rules to related to access and transparency, which I'm not going to cover today. But taken together, I think a good case can be made that the effects of those package of changes have been beneficial. The system has continued to innovate, merchant card payment costs have fallen. It's also notable that merchant costs are significantly lower in Australia than in a jurisdiction like the United States, where card payment performance has been much more limited. The Murray Report last year broadly endorsed the PSB's reform approach while flagging a number of areas for further consideration, particularly in relation to surcharging and interchange. And these have now been taken up as part of the PSB's card payments review. The issue of surcharging remains contentious. Instances of apparently excessive surcharging have existed. While schemes acknowledge arguments for what might be called a no excessive surcharge regime, they have argued that the current formulation is too complicated and difficult for them to enforce. The CARS review is looking at several possible mechanisms for addressing this. One option proposed by Murray is a tiered approach that would allow tougher surcharging constraints to be placed on low cost cards. But there are also a number of other options available to strengthen enforcement and disclosure practices, for example, by allowing schemes to cap surcharges that are not percentage-based at some low fixed amount. All of that has been canvassed in our issues paper published earlier this year. On interchange fee regulation, there are a number of issues to consider. These include the overall level of the interchange cap, the complexity and proliferation of interchange categories, the phenomenon of interchange drift with the 3-year compliance cycle, and the wide disparity between interchange rates for preferred merchants compared to those applying to others. While it's broadly endorsed the PSB's regulatory approach to date, the Murray Report recommended that consideration be given to tightening existing interchange regulations in some significant respects. These included lowering the interchange cap and broadening its coverage to include other incentive payments that serve a similar function. Murray argued that this would help to prevent circumvention and also, in the case of companion card arrangements, would help to improve competitive neutrality. All of these things are now being carefully considered as part of the PSB card payments review. As I said at the outset, that review process is still underway, and I'm not going to preempt any possible conclusions from that today. Reserve Bank staff have already consulted extensively with interested parties, and I expect that there'll be more consultation to come in response to the submissions that have been received. At this point, I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank industry participants for your participation in the process. It's important that we consult, that we hear your views, and I thank you for the way that you engaged with us, not just in this review, but also in our wider agenda of promoting a more efficient payment system. Thanks very much for listening.
We've probably got time for just one question. Not really. Anybody want to ask the RBA something?
Consumer credit card benefits
be at risk? Well, all of those things are linked together. The typical pattern of flows is that interchange, interchange tends to serve a function while shifting the reward and cost balance between the merchant and the cardholder. So high interchange tends to promote an environment where you can fund high rewards, but it also raises significant costs onto merchants, which are then going to be passed on in some form to consumers as well. So there's a lot of churn going on there, but the general point that we've been making is that the sort of competition we've been seeing has tended to work in the direction of increasing merchant costs, which is bad for consumers.